presume again, thank you. For day three, Ms. Scott, over you. Any preliminary issues?
Not this morning, Mr. Chair. I do have some comments to hand up. They don't relate to Mr. Davis, but I'll just wait for them to come around.
Well, I wonder if we should get them over now. We can file them and go forward.
The first is the extra report.
Yes, thank you.
Overlay of the full development consent development at Lake Mackay that you sent out last week.
Thank you.
And that is all for now.
Evidence in relation to ecological matters regarding proposed rezones and adjustments to SNAs within the Upper Clutha area of the proposed district plan. From an ecological perspective, I do not oppose any of the rezoning requests within the urban area. This view is based on the lack of remaining ecological values within the urban environment. I do not oppose the majority of submissions on the urban rural fringe, as most of the indigenous vegetation has been removed from these areas. However, I do oppose the Scott Maisie Family Trust submission requesting the rezoning of half of SNA E18H for residential activity, which would undermine the values of the SNA through the clearing and fragmenting of the Tanuka woodland. I also oppose the Murray Blennerhassett submission 322, which seeks to have the urban growth boundary of Wanaka extended to the west and have this area rezoned from notified rural zone to rural residential or rural lifestyle zone. The proposed site boundary has not been defined, but from the description of the location provided and aerial imagery, Tanuka woodland and possibly areas of native grasslands are present. I consider the ecological values of the site need to be better understood prior to intensification of land use, and I oppose this rezoning from an ecological perspective. In the rural area, I do not oppose the majority of requests based on the lack of indigenous vegetation systems or the provisions for maintenance of existing vegetation and or ecological restoration work. I oppose the submission of Cross Hill 531 as the site contains ecological values including threatened plant species that require more detailed assessment than currently provided. I oppose two of the three rural lifestyle areas sought by Lake Mackay Station based on the presence of indigenous vegetation and a lack of ecological impact assessment information to support the rezoning application. Glenbu Bay Trustees Limited requests provision for a Glenbu Station zone. From an ecological perspective, I do not oppose the submission providing a revegetation strategy is required through the consenting process for activities across all proposed subzones. Based on Dr. Judith Roper Lindsay's evidence, I understand this is the intention, see paragraph 53, 55 of her evidence in chief, but currently the provisions only provide for a revegetation strategy within the activity area R. I consider that GSZ should be amended to provide for a revegetation strategy within all activity areas. I oppose most of the requests for removal or modification of SNA boundaries, as I consider all of the SNAs identified have ecological values that meet the significance criteria that was set out in my evidence presented in the rural hearing stream 2. I've made a minor modification to the eastern boundary of SNA E30A, which essentially tightens the boundary along the shrublands community within the SNA. Allenby Farms Limited has requested an alternative SNA boundary for Mount Iron SNA through its evidence. The alternative SNA would remove approximately 9 hectares of carnauba woodland from the existing SNA. Allenby Farms ecologist Dr. Calvin Lloyd justified the exclusion of the native vegetation as Dr. Lloyd considers the carnauba woodland is not representative of the original vegetation and that the SNA has been identified solely on the basis of the threatened environment classification. However, the Mount Iron SNA seed contains carnauba woodland that is representative of the original vegetation, with modelling suggesting it may have once been one of the main species present. That's based on Leithwick and Walker 2003. Given carnauba woodland within lowland environments of the Upper Clutha has been shown to be a community representative of the original indigenous vegetation cover, and the very restricted distribution of indigenous vegetation within these lowland environments, the carnauba woodland meets the significance criteria. Recent ecological investigations of the site by wildlands consultants has also identified that the carnauba woodland is utilised by Kawarau gecko, listed as at risk of declining. Indigenous invertebrates and brown creeper that, according to wildlands, have substantial gaps in their distribution and are generally present only in areas with extensive vegetation. In my view, this information provides further support for the carnauba woodland within Mount Iron SNA is significant and should remain in the SNA. Allenby Farm's proposed alternative SNA would also extend the boundary of the SNA to the south. I agree with Dr. Lloyd that the area identified to the south of the current SNA also has significant ecological values, and hence why I have previously supported and continue to agree with an adjustment to extend the southern boundary. With regard to Allenby Farm's proposal for residential building platforms within the Mount Iron SNA C, I oppose the inclusion of building platforms 10, 11 and 12. I note that the proposed building platform 10 is within an area required to be replanted by a court enforcement order after the illegal clearing of native vegetation within this SNA in May 2016. I could support the inclusion of the building platforms 3 to 9, 13 and 15 within the SNA, provided the conditions stated in my rubber evidence were met.
Thank you, Mr. Davis. Ms. Scott, before I invite commissioners to ask Mr. Davis questions, I noted on Monday's OMA net a note of a High Court decision, I think it's in the Christchurch process, related to appeals from Forest and Bird, that I think bears on the matters raised in Mr. Davis's evidence. I'd be grateful if you were able to, before the end of the week, address me on the significance, address us on the significance of that decision, because just reading the note, it seemed to me to be an absolute answer to the LMS request to vary the SNAs through with tracks through them, and if that is the position, well, I want to know if that's the council position, in order that I can then ask Mr. Kelly to address it rather than just to look at the reply, because that wouldn't be fair on Mr. Kelly. Now, Mr. Munro, I'd like to go first. Since you're closer.
Sure. Taylor Franklin for Davis Farm. In terms of the various submissions where you've agreed with the release or on the basis of no troubling ecological effects, just as a way that the evidence has been presented, it's looked at a whole bunch of individual submissions, and so I really just want to close the loop and ask whether you have any concerns from a cumulative perspective. Were we to agree with all of the rezonings, there wouldn't be any net or total ecological effect of concern that might arise.
The submissions that I have I haven't opposed, in the entirety of those submissions, I agree that that the values within those areas are so low that yes, you can.
Okay, thank you. In terms of those submissions where you've indicated opposition, some of them I think you have made mention to is a lack of information rather than definitive evidence that you were just in conclusion of. Accepting that you're not a planning expert, but do you have a sense of whether or not any of those areas of uncertainty could be or would be satisfactorily addressed through subsequent subdivision or resource consent processes or not?
Yeah, I think they could be.
And so turning specifically to the Elmley Barnes matter and those building platforms in particular, you mentioned you could support subject to conditions A to F outlined in your rebuttal evidence.
And
they're quite specific. Do you know, and it might be a matter that Mr. Barr takes up, do you know whether all of those matters you've listed could be taken care of through proposed consent requirements, or would any or all of these matters be over and above what a consent process could allow to be dealt with? Maybe you don't know.
All of these matters I have seen addressed on consent conditions.
So the question would be probably to Mr. Barr whether or not the proposed matters that would relate in this instance will allow all of those matters to be taken care of or not. We can come back to that when we talk to you later, Mr. Barr. Would be my preference. I've got no other questions, please. Commissioner Hudson.
Good morning. Yes, I've just got one, Mr. Davis, and I just wanted to understand a little bit more about your role in the assessment of SNAs throughout the district. And in your introduction, in your evidence in chief, you were talking about that you've completed the first initial identification in collaboration with other consultants.
Yep.
So can you just help me understand where that has got to in relation to the specific nature of all of these SNAs, as in, do you see that there are still gaps in the identification of SNAs, or in terms of your evidence, you've recommended some refinements? So can I just get from you some understanding of your involvement in that, or whether you're relying on other people to provide that information to you?
I have been heavily involved in the SNA process from the very beginning. There were another three local ecologists who helped me out. That was Simon Beal, who works at Opus. But I was I probably did the lion's share of the fieldwork associated with getting out. And so we initially did the desktop assessment, which identified the areas that we wanted to go and have a look at. And then, so I did a fair amount of that, the fieldwork to confirm whether or not those values that were identified in the desktop were present, and whether or not we should. In consultation with the other ecologists, we then determined whether or not we should take them forward. That's not to say there's still not SNAs out there. I don't think this process is ever going to be absolutely perfect. But, you know, I think we've got a fair way down the track with the project.
Well, thank you. That's helpful. And so in relation to the specific submissions, you've focused your attention on those and revisited them
That's right.
For the purpose of making a recommendation.
That's correct, yes.
Thank you. I find that really helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I think I'm sort of following on from Mr. Monroe and trying to deal with you as ecologist and also with the planners, but because it does seem to be, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but a bit of a disregard for the SNAs from specifically from Allenby Farms, and you'll be aware that there's a council. There was litigation involved.
Yes.
And
one of my employees is involved in that project. So.
Hopefully not on the wrong side.
No, we're on with the council.
But there are significant gains obviously to be made in changing this environment. And you have suggested, as you has been pointed out with A2F and in that particular application, that there are mitigation methods. I've seen lots of evidence about how hard it is to propagate, to grow, to ensure the success of native plantings, even with watering,
yep.
Especially on a hilltop environment, which is quite a dry environment. In terms of successful, how successful are these mitigation measures actually going to be? I mean, that's future gaming, but...
I think the toughest part on the placement... I think one of the hardest parts about restoration work on a place like Mount Iron is how we deal with the rabbits, rabbit control. They're just prolific. And they just get into everything. One of the reasons why the kanuka on Mount Iron is so prevalent is that it isn't necessarily so selected by the rabbits. So that's why it's managed to get away, I think. And if you walk through there now, you can see kanuka coming away, seedlings and saplings. So the kanuka, the rabbits tend to stay away from those. But other species will need quite a lot of help to get going, and certainly would need rabbit protection would be the fundamental piece of that, I think.
So that's going to take a lot of commitment from the developer.
Yes.
Do you see that commitment?
I see the commitment elsewhere in the community. So it really comes down to I can't speak about Allenby Farms at all. But I think you can do it. But it will be a pretty big commitment.
Thank you. Something that you've mentioned a few times is the submission, across various submissions, does not provide enough ecological information. Is this a recurring theme? Not want to put words in your mouth, but a poor cousin of the whole process?
it's a bit of a difficult position to be in as an ecologist because you are... you're getting it out, you're not doing a detailed ecological assessment, you're getting out, you're having a look and getting a feel for the environments that the that potential development may occur on. Having worked in the area for quite a long time, I've got a pretty good feeling for the sorts of values that are associated with these areas. So that's really, between that and getting on site and having a look around, that's really what's given me my... drawn my position for where we're at. That's not to say that more detailed assessment, which is what I think I highlight in my evidence, that's not to say that more detailed assessment wouldn't get you there with regards to a development application, but without it, it's difficult, which is why I end up opposing it.
Probably last question, in terms of the ecology, I know it's from the landscape perspective, if you actually look at Mount Iron, as you say, and has been said before, it's a significant olive green kanuka body, massive planting, and you do see in, you know, exotics slowly creeping up, and they are definitely highlights round buildings. From an ecological perspective, is it possible to maintain the ecology with that slow creep of a different species, invasive species, wilding pine? Because Carnegie is a great pioneer that establishes other things through it. If this, from your perspective, an ecological perspective, if this does keep going up, is that basically the end of the ecology?
No, I'd like to think that the SNA is going to look after most of it. I think consent conditions can manage that to a certain degree, as long as there's not invasive plants being planted within those development footprints, then I think that should help the disbursement of other plants within the and across the Kānaka woodlands. As far as the Kānaka woodland goes, I would love to see it develop further. At the moment, there is a lot of Kānaka. There's not a lot of other species through it. There's also the opportunity that bringing in other sort of Caprosmas, Ilarias, Kōwhai, Totara, all those sorts of species that were there originally, that we could actually get those starting to spread out across the site. But I think the problem with that is, again, with rabbits and how they'll be controlled to allow that spread.
And would that be an appropriate condition of consent?
I think so.
Species?
Yep. Yeah, it's done. It's been done pretty, from what I've seen, consistent, pretty standard. Certainly in that area.
Yeah. Thank you. I want to pick up the issues following up on Commissioner Fowler's point that we had a discussion yesterday with the Council's landscape advisor about the appearance of other indigenous species, and talked about the desirability of those species or the diversity expanding closer to the original native cover of, for instance, on Mount Dion. What difference would that make to the appearance of the mountain, as discussed yesterday? At the moment there's a sea of deep green Kānaka.
Yeah. The key kind of species that we would like to see amongst it are a range of small leaf shrub thin plants. There's a suite of Caprosma, Ilaria and Kōwhai. And if we could get those through their use, I don't think you'd notice it too much, to be honest, because the Kānaka is always going to be a strong component of that woodland. Getting those species aren't about to take over from the Kānaka. The Kānaka will always be there. It'll keep regenerating. It's self-sustaining now. So having those sorts of species move through the Kānaka woodland, I think is actually a real positive for the Kānaka. And I don't think it would change the look of it very much, given that they're sort of a grey. Looking from a distance, they tend to be sort of a grey looking colour. I don't think they would alter it too much.
And the
difficulty is getting them established within that environment.
And the concern that Ms. Mousehold have is that if you had a planting regime around development sites, they might appear as an island of Kānaka on that hillside. Should I assume that, given your comment, that you wouldn't in fact notice that you wouldn't have the same concern?
Well, it depends a bit on what you use. I mean, I've seen some of the plants that have been put forward for some of the plantings, and it might look a bit interesting if you had a if you could get broadleaf to grow and sort of dominate a house site or something, then it would probably work for the house. But and I think one of the reasons why they don't put forward is that it's the flammability of the material of those species. I personally think it would be more in keeping with the site if we if they kind of looked to plant more of the small leaved shrubs, and I think you'll find that those you'd get those established better than more of the fleshy sort of plant. I mean, I think having a handful of broadleaf that were coming away through it wouldn't affect it too much from my perspective. My understanding is that those sorts of plants were originally on that site, but they've never get going at the moment. Not within the Kanuka, given the predator or the rabbits that are on that area.
When you say that sort of plant, you mean the broadleaves?
Yeah. So broadleaves, phytosporums, possibly some of the pseudopanics, but yeah.
And when you say that it would be easier to re-establish the small leaf, that's because they're more predator proof.
I think that they tolerate that environment a bit easier. From my experience, in those dry environments, you're better off planting the smaller leaf phytosporums and alerias. They tend to perform better.
Thank you. And going more generally, questions in my mind, given your description of the process of identifying SNAs, is because it was desktop, were you focusing on indigenous vegetation rather than habitats of indigenous fauna?
The original part of the process, yeah, way back in 2010, I think, or early, that was a desktop assessment, and we focused in on the areas that we wanted to look at, and every single one of those sites that we looked, we identified through the desktop were visited. So it was more than just desktop. We didn't confirm that the vegetation was there.
The point of my question is really, is there a potential that for sites that are significant because they are the habitat of rare and endangered birds or other herpetofauna that might have been missed because you were focusing initially on your desktop basis, you were focusing on vegetation, maybe that you would only get significant habitats of indigenous fauna where there's also indigenous flora, but is there a potential hole in the coverage for that reason?
There is a hole, I accept that. But what we did through the desktop assessment was we picked up all the threatened bird and gecko and skink encounters, so we overlaid that into a GIS. That sort of showed us where these particular records were, so we've got all those in the system. Then we've used a lot of literature, I guess, to support where those threatened species are likely to be in our landscape. that's really where we've got to. There's no doubt, and indeed the Wilders report found threatened species that within the Mount Iron SNA that we hadn't recorded through our process because we didn't go to that level of detail in our ecological assessment. As in, we didn't. There were no herbivore surveys undertaken. We were really using the indigenous vegetation to drive the habitat that it was the faunal values associated with that.
Question again at the more philosophical level is: are the residual habitats that you've identified representative of all of the habitats that were there naturally, or have some been entirely lost?
Yeah, I think there probably has been some that have been entirely lost. Certainly in the valley floors. And I also, in our lowland landscapes, I think that there is very few, if any, vegetation or habitat that hasn't had some level of modification. It all has had a fair amount of modification. Be that from invasive plants, clearance, or just the sheer number of pests that are out now, particularly in our lowland environments, they've all been changed. Even in our where we have cushion field communities, and this is actually an interesting observation I've made, is that some of those lowland cushion field communities, I think that those are actually maintained. Could well be maintained through the presence of rabbits, because they are actually keeping down the woody plant communities from moving into these sorts of environments, and they're clearly not eating the cushion plants. With these pests coming in, in some areas there's a new steady state that's occurred. So I guess in summary, I don't think there's really anything that hasn't been modified. And yes, we will have lost in systems entirely. Certainly, some of our wetland systems will have gone completely.
Now, you've noted the what we now what the Environment Court has held to have been illegal clearance of SNA. On Mount Iron, and the requirements to replant. The issue that occurs to me is that for whatever the legality of the plants having been removed, it has happened, it is a fact. Does that compromise the ecological values of the SNA up there? Should the SNA be withdrawn to reflect what now exists as a matter of fact?
Absolutely not. That area, from our, it undermines the values, but at the end of the day, that Carnuka woodland is representative of the original vegetation on Mount Iron. That in itself hits the significance criteria that we developed back in 2010-2011. They removed about, I'm not quite sure what the area, I think it was about a hectare of clearance of tracks. Whilst that is disappointing and doesn't undermine the values of Weaver, it's not enough to, in my mind, to remove from the SNA.
And presumably, the replanting that's been required
will support. Will help.
Will assist.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the arguments about what the reference point is that Dr. Lloyd is, the reasoning that Dr. Lloyd has advanced about how much Kānuka there is, and in particular radius out from Mount Iron, my recollection of previous cases where I've been involved or reviewed ecological assessments is that it's been regarded as relevant to determine the percentage of residual cover within an ecological district. Is that still a relevant factor?
Yes.
And what is the relevant ecological district? Where is it? How big is it?
Well, there's actually two ways in which it can be applied. It can be applied to the ecological district, or it can be applied to the lens environment. So both of those, I think, are applicable in this situation, and both are. They are both of them are much larger than what the 5 kilometre radius that Dr. Lloyd has advanced.
Would you get a materially different conclusion if you were assessed the percentage relative to the ecological district?
To the ecological district, you certainly would, yeah.
And what sort of percentage?
Can't give you the number. I haven't. And I think you certainly would with the lens environment as well. That is the standard application of the threatened environment classification. You use the land environment or the ecological district.
And the one might give you a comparison that would support or would not support the other.
Yeah.
Now, in terms of the big picture case that Allenby are advancing, in effect, what I would describe it as an environmental compensation approach in ecological terms, if you didn't have the luxury of adding the extra or the alternative SNA that Allenby are proffering in addition to the current one, and you had to pick which one provides the greater values, which one would it be?
If you didn't have the luxury?
If you didn't have the luxury of saying we'll have both, which is effectively your position at the moment, and you had to pick one, which is effectively what Allenby are offering, they're saying, we'd like to carve the northern part off,
that bit off
and add the southern bit.
Yeah.
If you couldn't, as you say, if you couldn't have them both, and you had the luxury of being able to choose which one of the two, which one provides the greater ecological values?
I think the one that they've offered up. It gives a bit of, it's interesting that we didn't pick up that grey shrubland that's on the southern face of Mount Iron in the original desktop assessment and then the fieldwork that followed. But I think it was just, there was a function of the tools that we were using at the time, I think. that it didn't really get. That area, I think, was originally described through the desktop analysis as a mixed exotic woodland rather than the grey shrubland that it really is today. Certainly that area has developed, I think, quite a lot in the last 10 years. There's a lot of Madagari and Caprosma, and it's also got some other good values that Wilding picked up with regards to threatened fauna. So I accept that would be a better SNA. Provides a better diverse range of habitat.
Thank you. And working down through your evidence and sheet, picked up paragraph 7.6, where you talked on about an assessment based on aerial imagery, identifying exotic pasture, grey shrubland, braided river, which provide habitat for threatened species.
Sorry,
7.6. Mine does.
Evidence in chief.
I don't know what I'm looking at. It's the discussion of the Pennycook and Boston Bird submission. Bottom of page 27.
Sorry, got it, yep.
Oh,
the
weird thing.
Yeah,
got it. Thank you.
You have 7 points. Hello. We're all on the same page. Thank you. The question is how you can determine the fauna present from an aerial imagery.
Oh, you can't. That's just from local knowledge.
Given that the site, the zone site obviously doesn't include the Broaded River, I think we need to separate out the extent you've identified threatened fauna.
Yep.
Is that in the river, or in the shrubland, or both? Or indeed in the pasture? Mm-hmm.
The threatened birds are, within the riverbed.
All right, thank you. And
the eastern falcon is also listed there. So that will utilise the shrubland habitat.
If I ask you to turn to your rebuttal evidence, I'm looking at paragraph 320. The sentence that you oppose the proposed alternative SNA as it does not accurately reflect the area of significant value. And I didn't entirely understand what you meant, so I'll ask you to clarify that.
Well, the exclusion of that 9 hectares of Kānuku woodland is what I'm referring to.
Yeah.
So the point is that the whole concept of an exchange is that you're losing something.
Well, I consider it significant. We've identified it as significant. They're taking it out of, they want it to be removed from the significance, from the FNA. My point is that I think it still has significant values.
And over the term of the page, you've said that you could support some of the proposed platforms. I suppose in essence my question is, what is it about sites 10 to 12 that marks them out, in your view, and distinguishes them from the balance?
The key part is that platforms 10 and 11 are right bang in the middle of the Kānaka woodland. The other lots are already quite open, so the modification to the SNA within those sites is a lot less than what would be required from the other sites.
And 12? You said 10 and 11.
10, 11 and 12. I need to be reminded of that. Does anyone, can I just have a look at that plan again?
Oh, absolutely.
The arms proposal, the lots on it. Yes, and 12 as well.
I want to shift focus to Lendu Bay.
Yes.
Your discussion of paragraph 4.3 of your rebuttal.
Yes.
And first question is about your whether you have a concern about the proposed extension of the golf course area, given that golf course will necessarily involve large areas of carefully manicured grassland, and they're proposing to take it down into the fern burn to the what was previously open space into a dip where the fern burn comes through there. Is that a concern to you? From an ecological point of view?
Can I get a plan showing where that is referring to?
Thank you.
And to give you some background, I asked Dr. Reed the same question from a landscape point of view, about whether from a landscape perspective she'd have a concern about clearance of the vegetation on the banks of the Fernburn, and she said, well, obviously she deferred to you on the ecological aspects, but she said she thought they were all crap willows and be no great loss.
I don't know if I can comment on it, to be honest. I'm not. If they are all crap willows, I'd accept that. And I think they probably are. From my recollection, there's vegetation in there is all exotic.
Yeah, there's a couple of poplars, but I think the majority is that river spread quite far.
Yeah.
Well, I think given that we can't rely on Commissioner McLeod, based on the site visit, we leave it on a conditional basis that if there are cracked willows, then you wouldn't have an issue. And I'll ask Dr. Rope Lindsay that same question.
Yep.
But more generally, just write that down. My reading of your position is that if, so long as any additional areas, additional activities that Glendale Bay are proposing over and above what's already consented require consent, and that the rules are broad enough to require a revegetation strategy, you wouldn't have an issue with that.
No, I think that's appropriate. Yeah. And that was the confusion that I had through the submission. I just thought that it needed to be extended across the whole zone.
The whole zone, or the whole of the activity area?
The whole of the activity area. Yes. Sorry. Yep.
So that wouldn't include the open space farming zone, for instance?
Yes, it does include open space farming zone, the revegetation strategy.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Any final questions?
Just a quick question. The guys, Florence McHugh and she put in a submission about Bullet Creek becoming an SNA, and you spoke about it in the rural heating stream it's just that from an ecological perspective, would it be, there is a wetland at the head of Bullet Creek,
yep,
which is currently being restored, but the Bullet Creek extends through the centre of a very built up separate tidal area. Is that viable to actually regenerate that from an ecological perspective, or is it something that's just gone?
I think it's pretty difficult to. I think the wetland at the head of it, I'm not familiar with that wetland, and given that it's getting restored at the moment, suggests that the values are pretty are probably pretty limited at the moment, from as far as the habitat goes.
Thank you.
Can you make it clear, Commissioner, which submission was that? Was that
Florence McHugh, it's actually 5.3 in the evidence in chief. 5.31 Florence McHugh submission 115. And it was to do with Bullet Creek being identified as an SNA. And Bullet Creek is very significant, but I don't know whether it will ever be an SNA. But the wetland at the head is Forest and Birds. It used to be, Fish and Game. And it's currently a lot of work being done because it's the headwaters of Bullet Creek.
The ecological values, just as a note, I think would, as far as the freshwater ecological values go, are probably fairly limited given that the creek has got trout in it.
Yep. So. Yeah. And as a Scotsman, I think at this point I should probably apologise for gorse, broom, rabbits. I wasn't there at the time. Trout. Yeah. Well,
we could make comments about the venerable age of our fellow commissioner, whether he can in fact deny all responsibility on that basis. Thank you very much, Mr. Davis. Appreciate your assistance and your evidence.
Thank you.
Okay.
One statement of evidence dated 1st of May in relation to dwelling capacity. He has also prepared a summary of his evidence. Because of the timetabling that we ended up having to work to for dwelling capacity evidence, there was rebuttal evidence provided by Ms. Hanson Beresford late last week, and Mr. Osborne has provided some comments in response. In his summary of evidence for the panel's benefit. So if I can ask you to read the summary.
Well, before we start, Ms. Scott, given that as you foreshadowed yesterday, or on Monday, Mr. Osborne's summary is rather longer than the directions of the panel would previously permit, I assume that you will have no difficulty if Ms. Hampson responds in kind.
The length of Mr. Osborne's summary is because he there was no opportunity to provide rebuttal evidence, as has been the case for all other submitted evidence filed. So this is one exception. I did direct Mr. Osborne to do that, so I take all responsibility for it. If Ms. Hampson has additional rebuttal to Mr. Osborne's rebuttal, then, or to his summary, we won't oppose that, sir. But the reason why it is longer is because we haven't yet had an opportunity to rebut Ms. Hampson's evidence.
As I say, all I want to be sure is that if I let this go past my eye, you won't oppose the Beresford team doing the same. But that's fine. But we don't have the summary, I don't think.
We've got an electronic copy, but we don't have a hard copy.
I've been engaged by Queenstown Lakes District Council to provide evidence in relation to the housing market and dwelling capacity in the Upper Clutha area of the Queenstown Lakes District. The district's housing market has seen significant and rapid changes over the past 15 years. These changes have resulted in substantial shifts in the affordability of homes, as well as important impacts on community wellbeing and the cost of living and working here. Outside of Auckland, the district has the highest nominal average house price in the country, with a growth rate exceeding that experienced by any other area in New Zealand. While the residential housing growth rates in Auckland have been subdued over the past 12 months, the district has not experienced the same tempering of growth, with an average price of over $1.05. The level of affordability has resulted in home ownership levels across all households being only 35% and only 8% for those under 44. It is estimated that over the past 15 years, residential housing demand rose by nearly 7,000 homes, while the corresponding supply fell short, and it's between 600 and 1,200 homes, by over 1,000 homes. This latent demand is currently playing its role in the ongoing pressure on house prices and affordability. Since 2006, the district has experienced the largest fall in home ownership rates across the country, with an average mortgage accounting for over 50% of disposable income. A key component of the property market in the district is the number of vacant site transactions. These are not only high in terms of quantum, but also in terms of the number of transactions per property. This would indicate a significant market in land speculation. A further unique factor in relation to both the district and Upper Clutha residential property markets is the level of private visitor residents that absorb considerable levels of residential land for temporary non-residents. This section of the market accounted for 33% of the Wanaka Ward dwelling in 2015. The Upper Clutha makes up approximately 38% of the district's dwellings, with 6,400 in 2015. This is expected to rise to over 11,000 by 2048, growth of over 90%. From the 2015 base, that's approximately 5,000 new dwellings that are required. As indicated by the changing home ownership and affordability rates, an increasing proportion of this demand will be required in the lower price and income brackets. It is essential in terms of economic well-being that the PDP consider the changing residential environment in the district. The district has the opportunity to contribute to addressing the issues of affordability and build supply through provision of sufficient, feasible capacity, as well as medium and high density residential development in central locations. Property Economics have undertaken development of a feasibility model to advance the enabled capacity of residential dwellings provided by council. This feasibility model has been developed to better understand if the district has sufficient enabled capacity for sites that the market is likely to develop at a given profit margin. Several assumptions and market variables were considered in this model, including the key assumptions that are listed there, things around consistent planning regimes, and also average market behaviour. Things that weren't considered and were assumed in the model is things like sufficient infrastructure, that although there is an interactive nature between demand and supply within the market, that was held constant. That is, that the changes in supply in a particular area didn't necessarily lead to changes in demand. So if we supply more and more land in Wanaka, we're not going to change those fundamental rationale demand projections in terms of the number of dwellings required. The variables were fixed over time. The costs of development and so forth, and other proportions such as the 20% profit margin were all fixed over that period of time as well for 2048. An interesting one was that no consideration of amalgamation was given in the model. That is the opportunity for sites to be aggregated in a particular area and thereby increase the capacity within that area. The last one there, feasible capacity was based on the highest return. There were two, in the Auckland example, there were three, in fact, types of assessment that were run. Two of those included the highest return and the highest number of outputs, number of units that were resulting. Those were different in Auckland because there was an opportunity to actually produce at a suboptimal and lower than capacity output and still get a higher return. In the Queenstown market, that's not as an evident factor. That is that the highest return often coincides with the greatest number of units produced on a given site. No suboptimal development options were considered. That is that, say, if you can build 5 units on a particular site, that's the number that was actually given in terms of the feasible or the enabled capacity, and therefore it was feasible, the feasible capacity. The key variables that were actually assessed are listed there. The model itself was run for the district, the Queenstown and Upper Clutha areas. In total, the enabled capacity resulted in just over 14,000 dwellings within the Upper Clutha area, with just under 9,000 of these being deemed feasible. It was important to reflect in the final numbers the potential for variances from the market averages that were applied at a site-by-site basis, given the development chance that would factor into the realisation of built form from the feasible development potential. A key assessment, and it's reflected in the provisions of the NPS as well, is the fact that even though it may be feasible at a 20% margin to actually develop land, there are other factors that may contribute to that land not being developed, whether it be land banking, whether it be motivation of individual landowners to hold on to a larger site and not subdivide or not develop it. There needs to be a degree of fat, as it were, or margin in there that is considered that won't actually enter the market in terms of capacity. In the Auckland example, that was labelled as development chance. As indicated above, the land market in Upper Clutha operates in the market in which Upper Clutha operates has factors associated with it which would indicate a proportionately high level of land speculation. This factor, coupled with the level of areas with identified capacity, would alter this development chance, especially in the short to medium term. And so a higher rate was applied to 50% for the modelled capacity. The final capacity resulting from the model parameters for Upper Clutha was 5,416. As identified in my evidence, this model is a work in progress, with additional layers to still be considered. After filing my evidence in chief, two areas within the model have been identified as being misallocated geographically. This update therefore removes Arthur's Point from the Upper Clutha area and includes North Lake. Correction of these two errors resulted in an additional 1,300 dwellings with the figures identified within the council's fixed capacity areas. Feasible capacity of 301 has also been excluded from the rural lifestyle zone of Makarora for reasons outlined in the evidence of Mr. Barr. Additionally, the table below includes higher density dwelling potential, identified by council, within the Wanaka town centre zone of 50 dwellings. The material changes to the Upper Clutha zones result in the total capacity increasing from 5,416, as per Table 2 in my evidence in chief, to 6,615 dwellings. The table below identifies the areas in which this capacity lies. In considering the sufficiency of this capacity, it is appropriate to have regard for future residential dwelling demand within the Upper Clutha area beyond the period of the PDP. As identified, the projected dwelling demand for Upper Clutha 2048 is expected to be approximately 5,000 dwellings. When considering the modelled areas and areas identified by council, it is expected that, even with a modelled development chance of 50%, that there is more than sufficient capacity at 6,615 dwellings. Only one statement of evidence was filed by submitters in response to my evidence on dwelling capacity. Because of the time frames, I understand this is not allowed for rebuttal evidence. However, I wish to make the following comments on Ms. Hampson's evidence. In relation to my evidence and the results of the modelling undertaken by Property Economics, Ms. Hampson's evidence in her paragraph 7.1 is that even with her demand adjustments, the position held in my evidence in chief that there is sufficient feasible residential capacity is still relevant. Ms. Hampson has gone on to identify some issues that she believes may overstate the potential capacity that will be provided by the market. In paragraph 411 of her evidence, Ms. Hampson identifies a concern over the treatment of a realised capacity for what she calls Stage 1 and non-Stage 1 zones. As identified in my evidence in chief, the realised component of the assessment relates to the development chance that is associated with the market actioning feasible capacity at either optimal or suboptimal levels. The NPS C1 identifies this potential position and determines that consideration should be made at 20% over the short to medium term and 15% over the long term discount rates. As stated in my evidence, the district currently exhibits higher than average levels of land speculation. And although this may be a short-term issue for the market, it has played a role in the consideration of a discount rate higher than that identified in the NPS. In considering the practical implications of discounting individual special zones and the potential concerns of individual developers at representing significantly lower development rates, the property economics model considers the realisation rate as a whole. As such, the 50% rate applied to the model represents a realisation rate of just over 30% when considering the whole Upper Clutha market, significantly more than the 20% or long-term 15% required by the NPS. I therefore consider that, at a ward level, the realised capacity figures are conservatively represented by the final capacity numbers recorded in my evidence. In paragraph 5.18, Ms. Hampson identifies my previous discussions outlining the potential level of latent demand within the district. This position has been reiterated in the summary, in which I estimate demand over the past 15 years at 7,000 dwellings, with a shortfall of approximately of between 600 and 1,200 dwellings over the same period. The Upper Clutha area currently accommodates around 35% of the district's dwellings and is expected to remain at this composition rate through to 2048. Over the last 15 years, Upper Clutha has housed over 40% of residential building consents. This would imply that the shortfall experienced by the district has not been as high in the Upper Clutha area. As such, I would estimate the latent demand in the Upper Clutha area as no more than 150 dwellings. While this small figure has not been specifically included in the total demand figures, the number itself is relative to the demand figures utilised by Rationale beginning at 2015. This total demand includes a period of 2 years where over 600 residential building consent applications have been processed in the Upper Clutha area. As such, I do not believe, when considering these two factors, that their consideration would result in a lower net capacity for the area. Finally, at paragraphs 5.6 and 5.9, Ms. Hampson addresses the geospatial distribution of demand within the Upper Clutha area. While the DCM model has been applied at a site-by-site basis, the model itself is based on area and district averages, and as such has not been reconciled with demand at a level beyond that of the ward. This is due in part to the fact that realisation rates are not consistent across dwelling typology or location, and can change significantly over time as perceived risk within the market alters. It is also important to note that, as identified in my evidence in chief, demand and supply are interactive, with areas with increased supply capacity often resulting in corresponding demand. One of the important factors just there as well is that, especially in the Wanaka market currently, albeit that smaller locational factors drive demand within the Wanaka ward within Upper Clutha, one of the most significant driving factors at the moment is price. And so something that ultimately we're hoping to refine this model, especially with regards to the Queenstown evidence, is to look at the feasible capacity and what that results in terms of affordable product or in terms of those price ranges. And that in itself actually is a big driver of demand, where you can actually produce lower ranges of housing options. So you're looking for choice in terms of location, but you're also looking at choice in terms of price brackets. No information provided in Ms. Hampson's rebuttal evidence would alter my economic position that the PDP provides sufficient residential development opportunities to meet future demand projections within the Upper Clutha area over the long term.
Thank you, Mr. Oswald. I just want to make seek some preliminary classification before I hand it over to my colleagues to ask you questions. The question I have rolling around in my mind, and I was, I have to confess, I was left in a state of some confusion, is about this concept of realised capacity. And I wondered if it was being used in two different contexts. At paragraph 21, your discussion implies that realised capacity is forward-looking, what I would call realisable capacity, rather than historic. Have I got that right?
That's correct. The concept of realisable capacity is what we're talking about there in terms of what the market is likely to actually produce as opposed to what is viable in the market.
And as such, do I understand your response, Ms. Hampson, as being that realisable capacity is a subset or is a subset of feasible capacity?
That's correct. Yes.
And in going to your table, paragraph 16, is realised capacity used in the same sense there as that historic?
Again, when we're talking about realised capacity, we're looking at what the market is likely to realise.
So
it's realisable capacity.
It is forward-looking.
Yes.
And the last point of clarification arising out of your summary is you have a line item, special purpose. Is that the same as special zone like North Lake?
Those are the special, that's the aggregation, I believe, of the special zones, yes.
Market like the Glooper, possibly even the district as a whole, to what extent or what proportion of the market or demand is price sensitive, i.e. more capacity might actually help meet that demand? And what proportion is what you might call amenity sensitive? That is to say, it's people who have got lots of cash and are coming here for a specific outcome, which might include there aren't that many people around.
I think there are... one way of answering that is that those markets are proportionally changing at the moment. That is that the market that is price sensitive in the Queenstown area especially is increasing over the ones that historically were amenity sensitive. Because of the increasing economy of Queenstown, there are a lot more, there's a requirement for a lot more service workers, there's a requirement for workers that support local industry to find somewhere to live as well. So that proportion is definitely increasing. We've looked at average incomes and so forth, and we haven't necessarily reconciled those with home ownership, but in terms of the proportion of the resident population, the lower two quartiles of the market is definitely the majority of the additional new houses that are being required in Queenstown. So it's an increasing proportion, and in terms of the additional market, definitely the majority of that proportion moving forward.
And that then has a direct consequence, doesn't it, to the type of housing that that one would be trying to promote to meet that demand, which is typically smaller sections, easier lifestyles, all that stuff is pretty well known.
Yeah, I think it's that, and it's about the we talk about affordable housing, but one of the things that is becoming an issue is also the cost of living, and so it's where those affordable houses are actually located. It's like we're putting them right on the fringe and then expecting people to be able to find their way in.
Again, thinking about the market in this district, in this part of the district rather than nationally, one could characterise it as a smaller market with a limited number of active developers. Theoretically, lots of individual owners that might have capacity to slice off the back half of the section or something like that. Will there always be some degree of shortfall of supply to demand in terms of developers not intentionally looking to lose money by needlessly throwing sections on the market when they might make more money restricting it? That is to say, even if we give every developer unlimited supply, are they still going to limit what they actually deliver out of their own self-interest, as you'd expect in normal markets? So
I think there are, in regard to that, and in regard to individual motivations, there are positives and negatives, and as you've identified, in terms of capacity, there will always be those who choose to speculate in terms of long-term gain over actually entering into the market and developing. At the same time, any model like this that looks at capacity is looking at it at a moment in time. And so a lot of the land that we may deem as unfeasible or doesn't enter into that capacity, there may be different motivations and different time frames involved with the owners of those lands. So they may well have, instead of having to buy it now, have owned it for the last 30 years, and therefore the profit gains are not off the what's worth now necessarily to buy and develop, but it owes them very little essentially. So there are obviously some positives in terms of that capacity as well. Yes, we'd expect, and I mean that's in terms of the development chance, we would always expect there to be a shortfall in terms of what the market deems feasible and what actually enters into the market in terms of those different motivations. And you'd always expect to see some degree of speculation in the market, yes.
Where it leads to, in my mind, is every single submission that wants a rezoning says we will serve the NPF because there's more capacity. Is there a point where the marginal benefit to the market of more supply, theoretical supply, doesn't actually make a difference? And is there a certain point where only so much can be delivered and more supply is actually just purely academic?
Yes. There are two points essentially. One point is where you continue to supply and have enough capacity that the price drops and you don't get the development. And essentially the area that is hurt is redevelopment. Because you've got existing buildings and existing improvement value, you will find that if you continue to increase capacity, you will only typically, you won't get the margins that are necessary to discount that improvement value. So you'll only really get that fringe and greenfield development occurring. And so there's that, yeah, that aspect of continued supply. You've got obviously the cost of servicing, but at some point, that marginal cost is going to exceed the marginal benefit of continuing to increase supply.
And so steering away from the path of questions that tries to pin the tail on that donkey, another way of interpreting what you said could be that additional capacity is not always the desirable or correct outcome.
Absolutely not. I mean, you want a certain pattern of development, sufficient first of all, from an economic point of view, and continuing to provide more and more supply not only potentially undermines the existing supply and the ability for the market to actually finance that supply, and the certainty of actually purchasing land or development in Queenstown. But it comes at significant ongoing costs. Otherwise, we would negate any potential risk of undersupply by just continuing to supply.
Okay. That's paragraph 11 of your summary, your key assumptions. I was interested in deemed sufficient infrastructure, which of course is not something you're an expert in, but I did want to test with you that, again, turning to the submissions that frequently assert serving the NPS by more capacity, yet few of those seem to have any evidence that infrastructure might be available. Notwithstanding that you've considered a whole range of assumptions and variables, it seems to me the NPS is quite clear that infrastructure needs to be in consideration. Would that count as a factor, in your view, where notwithstanding, let's put it another way, if we were to entertain submissions seeking more zoned capacity, that was, in the first instance, fit in the enabled category. Then, when one works through the subsequent questions of feasible and realisable, the absence of infrastructure could effectively kill off those requests. Is that a fair way of me thinking through how we assess those?
If the majority of those developments, the infrastructure costs are internalised, then yes, essentially that would discount a lot of those enabled capacity areas.
Okay. What in the model is the relationship? Now I'll start again. What counts as a dwelling?
In the model, that's been defined really by the enabled capacity, which again has been defined by council. We've in terms of the areas that we've looked at, we have simply looked at the dwelling size and dwelling type within those areas and based that on what currently sits there, simply because we're taking an average price for an area and we need to represent an average house.
What I'm asking is what is, not for the purpose of the numbers of the model, what's the relationship between a dwelling, i.e. a building, a site, which is a property title, which might have one or more buildings on it, and a household, which are an independent family type unit that might live in a dwelling, of which you might have more than one household in a single building, and you might have more than one building on a single site.
Absolutely.
So where the model counts one, I'm trying to understand whether that actually means multiple households, multiple buildings, multiple sites, or any combination thereof.
So the model deals simply with the built form, and so it is dealing with a dwelling regardless of whether there are multiple dwellings on one site. So if it counts two dwellings, it can count two dwellings on one site.
Right.
So it's not site by site, although it's site specific in terms of the way it develops. It can in fact count more than one dwelling on a given site.
But in terms of the occupants of the dwelling?
In terms of the occupants of the dwelling, that's being developed more by the rationale demand that is related to those two. Yes.
Okay. So one, it seems to me, area in which the model might be being slightly conservative could be those households in the community that choose or want to share a dwelling between them. So you might have two households actually being quite happily met by one dwelling for reasons of social factors or financial circumstances or whatever.
And that's part of the initial work that was done that showed that there was a potential shortfall. It was dealing with households rather than dwellings at that point and saying here's the household growth, and it hasn't necessarily met it. And that's where you get that more than one household per dwelling is occurring. There's not 600 to 1200 households sitting out without a house to live in.
But is it fair though, what I'm trying to tease out with you, is it fair to assume that in some of those cases multiple households in a dwelling isn't a bad thing that they don't want?
Absolutely,
there are some cases people would love to have their own bed.
I mean, that was quite a contentious point, I guess, in Auckland, where there is certain cultural parts of the community that actually find it a desirable way of living. So yes.
Commissioner, I know it's
11:30. Are you happy to carry on? Would you like to break?
How much more have you got left?
If you're in the zone, swing with it.
I don't think I've seen too much more to go. One of the questions that's been on my mind to date, and I think one of your previous answers is suggestive of where you might go, but you might not here, is that I've been frankly surprised across the evidence and hearings I've seen how little recognition there's been from everyone of the permitted activity status of minor, the family residential flat, which could be a separate smaller house on a site, can be independently rented out, can't be sold or subdivided, but then your response previously has been it's about occupiable buildings. And so it would seem to me that the model doesn't seem to account for what could potentially be a large number of additional permitted dwellings that are just sitting in the zones that no one's counting.
And I think those are reliant on the economic environment. So depending on what happens to house prices, those may be necessary in order to actually finance a family home. So the willingness to give up certain parts of your lawn for another house really dependent on the economic environment more than anything else. And I guess what the model is essentially trying to do and what the PDP is trying to do is actually provide sufficient capacity so that people have a choice whether to do that. That's not something that becomes increasingly involuntary.
What I had in my mind was circumstances such as one model is purchases by a site, they effectively live in the small mining unit themselves but rent out the bigger house, and by the time they have kids of their own they're able to move into the big house. Another option could be a group of people together by a site, and depending on their shares, then one of them gets to live in the unit, one of them gets to live in the house, or whatever. But what I'm seeing is a huge amount of enabled additional dwellings that aren't counted. And of that I agree, one would have to work through a process of figuring out what proportion of those dwellings might be realised. But it's a number that I don't seem to see recognised, which would, if anything, add to the both enabled, feasible and realisable.
Absolutely. It may well, in fact, make some of the enabled feasible in terms of actually provide an additional dwelling without the additional land costs. That may well tip some of those that are deemed infeasible to the feasible category. So there is, I mean, there are a degree of a latitude within this, but as much as possible the model attempts to underestimate in terms of being conservative.
Well, my understanding is that at this point the model is totally silent on those particular dwellings, so it's not countable whatsoever. I could certainly understand in the case of existing sites.
The indication is that that is something that is going to be looked at, especially for the Queenstown hearing.
That doesn't help me much either.
But it's good to know.
One of the things I've got in my mind is I can understand that the existing developed sites where you've got buildings on the site, that there might not be room to fit the theoretical units on, but certainly in the greenfield zones, it seems to me that there could be a proportion of those identified where it could be seen as reasonably foreseeable and likely. And I would benefit from, if possible, some idea of what that might be, given the substantial number of residential allotments that are being entertained. High and medium density zoned is possibly less likely because you were tacking those units anyway, but certainly the low density, large lot, possibly even more residential and lifestyle, I think that's a question I would like to see with the best endeavours answered. I'd like to do more than just say we know it's underestimating, but we don't know by how much.
Commissioner, if I may just respond on that, there was a question earlier in the week of this nature, and work is underway, including for Upper Clutha, to provide that to you. In the last 2 days. But,
no, that's fine, but the question earlier to you was understanding the council's position,
yes.
And this is now a discussion with an actual expert. So I appreciate the overlap there because the council might rely on its expert, but I still see them as separate.
Yes, absolutely. Just wanted to let you know
thank
that
you.
We have taken that on board.
Okay, look, that's very helpful. I'm sure everybody's stomach in the room will thank me when I say I've got no more wisdom.
Well, in that case, we'll adjourn until 10 to 12.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair, just a clarification that we haven't actually finished with Mr. Osborne yet.
Correct.
Thank
you. We'll be back with Mr. Osborne after the adjournment.